Welcome to the Advisor Advocates Podcast. My name is Garrett Lill. I'm a certified financial planner and former advisor. And I started Advisor Advocates in this podcast to share with other advisors some of the experience that I like to say I accidentally accumulated over the course of my 13-year career, especially around the areas of the industry involving transitions from one firm to the other, advisor recruiting, M&A deals, things of that nature. Interesting thing for advisors that I've experienced in my career is that advisors are often on an island. We don't really know what's out there. We don't know what's going on outside the walls of our firm and outside the confines of our own practices. Especially when I was working in the recruiting industry and talking with advisors, there were just so many advisors who didn't know what they didn't know. So the purpose of this podcast and Advisor Advocates is to help bridge that information gap, to help advisors understand a little bit more about what the landscape looks like out there, what options are available to you, and sort of share some of the insights that I've ran into and hopefully answer some of the most common questions that advisors have. Everyone has known for years that technology has been a little bit of a tug of war force on the wealth management industry and on the practices of advisors, sort of pulling and pushing in opposite directions. On one hand, technology is greatly advancing the efficiencies in our practices and the way that we do business, and it's made it a lot more efficient than it was 15, 20, 30 years ago for sure. But on the other hand, it's also making it much easier for the public to make their own decisions and to handle their own finances without the need of an advisor, or at least that's been the perception from the public at least. So that's made it, on one hand, a little bit more challenging for advisors to get new clients or even to retain clients, and it's also driven down the cost of what advisors are charging. I talk to a lot of advisors and see a lot of financial statements, and at this point, I mean, I know 20 years ago, 15 years ago, most practices earned 80 to 100 basis points on their book of business, on the assets in their business. And that was before it was predominantly fee-based. That was when there was quite a bit of brokerage activity still going on. Now, even practices that are 100% fee-based, it's pretty rare to see an advisor who's earning at least 1% on their book of business. Or it's typically in the 75, 80% range, sometimes a little bit lower than that. So it's driven down the cost, and that's the term we've heard for a decade is fee compression, and it's been evident in the on the mutual fund side all the way down to the advisor side. But my purpose in this show and with Advisor Advocates in general, I think I'm learning that I'm better at asking how questions than I am answering what questions, right? So I'm not here to tell you that technology is changing the shape of the industry. Everybody knows that. But there are some reasons for that, and I also think some implications of that that may be right under our nose that we don't always think about. And I think my hope for this episode is to shed some light on some of those implications and maybe just give you some different thoughts or different insights to maybe consider, whether that's in your practice or in the ways you do business, because I'm not trying to change anybody's mind or change anybody's way of thinking. But I do think that there may be some things that you haven't really thought about that you may want to weave into your thought process when it comes to how you run your business, how you interact with clients, and the decisions that you make day in and day out. So breaking this down like the most fundamentally obvious level that you possibly can, I think it's pretty safe to say that technology provides the ability to perform objective tasks that do not require, logic, reason, emotions, empathy, some of those uniquely human characteristics. And it allows us to perform those tasks quicker and with less effort, and therefore more cost effectively than paying a human to do it. So really simple example of this, I don't know, 100 years ago, 200 years ago, ever how long it was ago that the calculator was invented. Before that time, someone who wanted to do an advanced math problem had to sit down and write it out on a piece of paper and think through it. Or certainly if they were very intelligent, they may be able to do some more complex problems in their head. But at the end of the day, it was a human performing that task. And the ones who were better at it could do it quicker and more accurately than those who couldn't. Calculators then kind of raised the bar on technology to a level where if you could punch the buttons correctly on the calculator, you could get the right answer. Funny little thing the other day that just kind of caught me off guard. I was helping my son with math problems, and there was something he needed to use his calculator for, and I said, well, go get your calculator and do that. And I promise you the next two words out of his mouth were, "Hey Siri." Okay, we've now reached a point where you don't even have to type in the numbers correctly. As long as the computer can hear you articulate your words clearly, you can tell the computer what answer you're looking for, and it can bring you back an accurate answer. So technology and computers and machines are becoming so advanced that they can do more and more things humans used to do, and they can do it much quicker, much more cost effectively. So it's making it exponentially easier for us to do our work, but it's also making it exponentially easier for our clients to replace us with the same computers that we're using to perform our work. So it's an interesting challenge that we've faced in the industry for a long time, and this is not a new phenomenon. Again, I'm not here to break the news story to you that technology is affecting our practices. But there is another implication of that that I don't think I had thought of until more recently, which is that there are still those human components of our jobs, and there are still subjective aspects of what we do, human empathy, understanding, caring for our clients, being able to exercise some type of judgment. Well, a computer's not going to do that. A computer has no empathy whatsoever for anyone. It doesn't have empathy for the client, and it doesn't have empathy for itself either. It's going to act objectively only on what is best for the client without any regard whatsoever for the emotional implications of that. For the truly empathetic advisors that are out there who really do mean it when they say they put their clients first and they really do care more about their clients than they do themselves, that actually ends up being an advantage for them in their practices rather than a disadvantage, because there are going to be some situations that a computer may not be able, because there is going to be an emotional component that comes into it, and the computer is not going to take that into account in its recommendation or in its financial planning or in anything else that it's doing, where the advisor can empathize with that and can relate something to the client that maybe the computer can't. So what we kind of thought was a disadvantage for everyone, I don't think is necessarily a disadvantage for every advisor and every firm that's out there. I think that what technology is really going to do is maybe in a final battle for all the ages, finally weed out some of the bad apples of the industry who have been acting in their best interests, and it's going to therefore leave even less competition for the good guys and gals of the industry who are doing it the right way, and it's going to create an opportunity for them. So to the purpose of the title of the show, that I think people are becoming the key differentiator, it's so funny to me, after I sold my practice and I started to work with advisors in transitions and in recruiting, I talked to a lot of the firms and I would always sort of ask, what are your key differentiators? What are the things that set you apart? And I was blown away by this. It was so funny and so ironic. Almost every single firm that I talked to gave me the exact same answer. Competitive payout, industry-leading tech stack, great human culture in some way, shape, or form. They might reword that last one just a little bit. A key differentiator, by definition, has to be different than everyone else. But when you evaluate financial advisors' practices and the firms, for the most part, everybody is putting out there the exact same key differentiators. And to say that you're putting your client first is no longer a key differentiator. In fact, it may have never been a key differentiator. It's more of a prerequisite to becoming a financial advisor. If you put yourself out there as someone who says, well, I'm going to act in my own best interest first, but I'll try to help you out along the way, you're not going to get any clients. Every single advisor at every single firm is saying that they're putting clients first. So when you make that your marketing slogan, you're just wasting real estate on your website. Yeah, you may have to say it, because if it's not there, maybe someone may think that you just don't want to admit that you put yourself first, but you can't rely on that as being the reason that people are going to choose you as opposed to working with Jim down the street or Susie across the town. You're going to have to dig a little bit deeper than just saying we put our clients first. So eventually I got frustrated with getting the same answers from all of these different firms. So I started just boiling it down to a simpler process where I would tell these firms, okay, just sell me on your firm. Tell me the one reason that I need to join you that is truly different than any of the other firms. It's one thing that I get when I work with you that I'm not going to get anywhere else. And even boiling it down to that, I still end up getting the same answer a lot of times. But it's also the nature of the business that we're in right now. A lot of this industry has become commoditized, okay? You can't rely on your technology anymore. You probably can't rely on your stock picking, although there are a few firms out there that truly do excel in asset management and in the investment process. But there are a lot of firms out there that are touting that they have that without really having it too. So that becomes a little bit watered down. It can't really be about your product mix, because most of the time, most of the firms are offering the exact same access to the exact same products. So at the advisor level in your practice, it's even more commoditized. There may be some firms out there who truly do have a proprietary technology that is a key differentiator. And that's okay. If you do have a technology that really is better than anything else that's out there, then sure, that can be your key differentiator. But I think in a lot of situations, when you think back to like sales school 101, you had features and benefits. And I think a lot of times what we think are benefits are really now becoming more just features. They are sort of fundamental things that are expected in our practices and are expected to be offered as a part of our firm that we're still leaning on to try to distinguish ourselves from the competition. And that may be out of laziness. It may be just naive that we don't know that our competitors have caught up with us. But for whatever reason, when I talk to firms and I talk to advisors, they all think that they have the same basket of things that make them special. And that is definitionally contradictory, because if everybody has the same special feature, it's no longer special. So that leads me back to what is the key differentiator. And I think in a world that is becoming more and more technologically advanced and more commoditized in so many different ways, that doesn't mean financial advisors are going the way of the dinosaurs and we're not going to be able to survive. I think 10 years ago, I think that is what I thought. You know, if technology keeps advancing at the rate that it's going right now, in 10 years, no one will want to pay for a financial advisor, or 50 years, or ever how long I thought it was going to take. No one's going to pay a financial advisor to do this anymore because a computer can do it all for them. I don't think that's true, because there are situations that I can go back to where I had conversations with clients that 100% could not have been taken care of by a computer. These were emotional conversations. These were things that you were appealing to the human side of the relationship rather than the objective financial numbers side of the equation. And those types of conversations are what start to separate you and start to set you apart. So I think if you fast forward, you know, X amount of years into the future and look at what I would maybe guess the industry is going to look like, and this is 100% just my opinion. I have absolutely no idea if I'm right, probably not. But I could see a situation where there are far, far, far fewer firms, far fewer advisors, and most clients have gone the way of technology and are doing it themselves or are using robo-advisors or some type of a low-cost solution. But others have sort of gravitated towards those advisors that are remaining. And that the commonality between these firms that are left is that there is going to be a true human element to their practice and a true compassion and empathy for the clients that they're working with and an ability to connect in the subjective realms of their communications and their relationships with clients that don't exist in the technology world. And the really cool side effect of that is going to be, once there's less competition and we've weeded out sort of the used car salesman of the industry, I think that you may see those surviving advisors be able to increase their fees. What you'll find is that for the clients who are left that want to pay for that service, they aren't going to the lowest bidder anymore. And they're not putting the premium on in their decision-making process on how much an advisor charges. They're looking for the best person. You know, this is a really, really bad way to explain it, but you don't necessarily pick the cheapest therapist, right? And I'm not saying that financial advisors are going to be therapists in 20 years. That's not where I'm trying to go with this. But people pick the therapist usually based on, you know, who's going to be the best fit for what they're looking to do. I was a golfer for a long time. I didn't pick my golf coach or the golf pro that I went to get golf lessons from based on which one was going to be the cheapest. It was more of which one was going to be the right fit for my game and what I was trying to work on in my game. I think there will be a laundry list of reasons that the public will select who their financial advisor is going to be, but I think they're going to be less based on product selection, cost, investment performance, and it's going to be more focused on who's the human on the other side of that. If that is where the industry goes, if I happen to be, you know, throwing darts here, but if I happen to hit the bullseye on that one, then as advisors now, how can we think about where the puck is going and how to position ourselves to be ready to capitalize on it as we get closer and closer to that point? Now, here's the earth-shattering part of the show. Here's the part that I think is maybe gonna hit you upside the head and surprise you. I don't have that answer, and I don't necessarily think that there is an answer for every single person out there. And I don't mean to please don't take this the wrong way, and I think I'll be interested to see when I go back and look at the analytics if this is a sharp drop-off in the video or the podcast. But there are some folks out there, you can't teach human empathy, okay? I would love to throw in a plug right here and say, hey, if you don't know how to find your key differentiator, call me and I'll help you. I can't help you find that. I don't know who can help you find that necessarily, and that's beyond the scope of this podcast, this even the scope of my entire business, that is a very deep, you know, soul searching type of a task that you may have to undertake. But I do think that part of this process might involve you kind of do some soul searching and think about, who am I in this for? Am I in this for me, or am I in this for my clients? And am I acting in that way? And I'm not telling you to figure out how to fake human empathy. I'm telling you that if you don't have it, it's going to be difficult to survive. If you're somebody, and I know some people like this, and it's not a, I'm not even saying this in a derogatory, judgmental type of way. Look, I have an ego. This industry is made up predominantly of folks with big egos. I love working with advisors and getting to know advisors, because I'm starting to see so many common themes between myself and other advisors. A lot of advisors have big egos. I wasn't the only one. I think it may even be a prerequisite to being an advisor more than it is a coincidence. But a lot of advisors have the same characteristics and a lot of the same personality traits. And frankly, a lot of advisors have either developed big egos over their careers, or they had great careers because they had big egos coming into it, and that helped their confidence and helped them to be the ones that shined over the last couple of decades. I'm not condemning the big egos. I'm just objectively trying to point out that the big egos are going to be the ones who probably lose eventually in the war with technology, where the truly empathetic, compassionate advisor and teams that really do put their clients first are going to be the ones who can survive a battle with technology, because they are able to provide the one thing that technology can't provide. I'm not really, you know, the purpose of this podcast and this episode is not to sit here and give you a big moral lesson about how to become better people. It's not that at all. And I apologize if it comes across that way. Technology is catching up on all of the things that we used to think we were better at than anybody else. And it's leveling the playing field. So you may be forced to kind of have a little bit of humility in advance and look at this and say, okay, am I the way I've been practicing, is that going to survive in the face of this advancing technology, or can I adapt? And I do think it's possible to adapt. It's beyond the scope of what I would ever try to cover on the show, but yeah, sure, you can adapt and learn how to develop more compassion. There are certainly different ways that you can do that. Or maybe it's time for me to exit the business. Maybe it's time for me to plug myself into a different team where I can do something that is a little bit more aligned with my skill set, rather than being set up for failure trying to be something that I'm not. So again, I'm probably a little bit better at asking you the deep why questions than I am giving you the answers that you're looking for. But you know, I think that's kind of the theme that we may be looking at moving forward, is that if you're not surrounded by a group of people who can actually put others' needs above your own, you're going to be commoditized and you may find yourself swimming upstream. And there are other ways that you can adapt your career, and there are ways to adapt your practice, and there are the ways that you can adapt just the way you do things to be able to survive. And I just want to kind of at least plant the seed there to kind of think through, okay, if Garrett's right about this by chance, if this random dude in North Carolina happens to be right about the way things play out, how are we going to be able to compete with technology at that point, and how can we adapt for that? And then secondly, be open with yourself to say, I know me, I don't want to change to become more compassionate and to become more empathetic. That's not my style. I don't want to be a therapist, you know, if it does go to that extreme. So, okay, does that mean that I'm dead? No, it doesn't at all. It just means that you need to have a battle plan for that, and you need to have a strategy in place for, okay, how are we going to adapt the business to be able to compete in a world where that those are the stakes and those are the rules. You know, I love the NFL, and the NFL of today is nowhere close to the NFL of the 1980s, 1990s when I first started watching it. And the successful teams in 2024 are not following the same strategies that the Steelers and the Cowboys and the 49ers did back in the 70s and 80s, because the game's changed. You know, it's a more pass-friendly league, and they're protecting quarterbacks, and there's a premium on speed probably over toughness now, at least compared to what it was 20 or 30 years ago. So if you are a team who sticks to those 1985 philosophies, you're probably drafting in the top 10 of the draft every year. And in the financial world, if you apply that, you're going to be out of business at some point, or you're going to be bought out at some point, or you're going to go away. So I just want to, you know, again, the goal is more to challenge your thinking than it is to criticize or to say, you know, who's doomed and who's going to be successful and who's not. Nothing that I do with Advisor Advocates is designed to pick winners or losers, or to promote one side of the coin versus the other. I try to just lay the facts up there and kind of say, okay, if this is what the landscape looks like, here's the information that you need to make the best decision for yourself and for your firm and for your family and for your clients. I'm not trying to say that I want this to happen. I'm not trying to promote it or to say it's right or to say it's wrong. I just think that it's something that is very real, and I wanted to provoke those thoughts a little bit and hopefully get the wheel spinning a little bit to maybe the way you evaluate your practice and the way you evaluate, you know, your interaction with your clients. And kind of closing it up a little bit, I will kind of give a case study of how I apply this in my work. I think when I left my work as an advisor and sold my practice and started to work in recruiting, I started to notice the way recruiters operated and did business. And there were some things that I looked at and said, okay, I see how they're doing that, and that makes sense. And there were other ways that I looked at it and said, no, that makes no sense, and I don't think they're doing it the right way. So when I started Advisor Advocates and kind of put my own spin on what a recruiting firm should look like, I've kind of noticed, and I don't even think it was necessarily on purpose to begin with, but as I started to notice that I have embraced it, that I do put that premium over people as opposed to what those bullet points are or those, you know, those key differentiators are. That for me, when I'm deciding who I want to partner with and who I want to work with and which relationships are going to be good relationships, I do put a premium on working with the good guys and the good gals and the good people in the industry, because I do think that's where the puck's heading. And as someone who's predominantly compensated based on my ability to recruit advisors to firms or to facilitate M&A deals, I'm a bit self-serving also. So I want to go where the puck's heading. So I try to align with the people that I think align with my vision for the industry. So I do think that even in the recruiting world and when advisors are making decisions about which firm to join, you know, look, all of the big firms have access to all of the same technology, or if they don't have the exact same technology stack, the tech stack that they have performs 99% of the same functions as their competitor and has the, you know, the same level of sophistication. So tech stack is not a key differentiator. Neither is compensation and competitive advisor payouts. It can be a disadvantage. You know, if you're running an employee model, paying everybody out 20% and making them go out and hunt and kill their own food, then yeah, you're at a disadvantage. But all the employee type models are paying about the same amount. All of the independents are paying about the same amount. All of the RIAs and the, you know, the turnkey RIA solutions are paying out about the same amount. And even if you are at a 95% payout and somebody else is at a 93% payout, that 2% doesn't make much of a difference to most advisors at that level if they don't feel like they can trust the people that they're working with, or if they don't have a good relationship with management at the firm that they're going to be joining. And one, you know, huge obvious point of this is, if you can't trust the firm and the people that you're working with anyway, then it doesn't matter what they offer you if they don't actually execute and fulfill their promises to you. Because if you're taking a deal with someone that you don't trust because they are offering you the best deal, then basically what you're doing is betting that your lawyers are better than theirs if it goes to court, and their deal minus legal expenses is going to come out better than the lesser deal that was with someone that you did trust. So in the M&A and the transitions side of it, it's still about people. It's still about working with people that you can trust, finding the people, you know, when you're looking at firms to merge with, looking for potential successors, looking for potential firms to transition your business to and, you know, become independent or maintain independence, looking for, you know, minority partners to come in and help you grow, looking for majority partners to buy you. It doesn't matter. Wherever you're going with your next transition, it should be about working with people that mesh well with you philosophically, that mesh well with you, you know, ethically, that there's some synergy there in the way you do things. That's the key differentiator that I see most advisors putting at the top of their list of things that they're looking for in recruiting and M&A situations. And I think that's very rightfully so, because if you don't have an ability as a firm to really have empathy for now your advisors, the same way the advisors need to have that empathy for the clients, if you're running a firm on the mindset of how do I maximize my profitability without alienating and pushing away the advisors, you're not going to survive either. You're going to have to take that a step further, I think, in the next 20 years and be able to say, no, how do I truly roll up my sleeves and get my hands dirty and be vested in the success of my advisors and actually put their needs maybe even above that of the firm, as long as it's something that can work, and really make sure that you're putting the advisors first rather than maximizing the firm profitability. Because I think you might be getting a bigger chunk of the pie right now, But I think what you're going to see is that your pie in general is going to shrink to the point of almost nothing down the road. And other firms, you know, they may be getting a little bit smaller cut of the pie, but it's going to be a pie that's going to be growing and they're going to be very successful. So I know that's something that I look for in my business. I look for the no jerk policy, I think, is maybe the entry point, but I think it goes beyond that. I think there are good folks out there that I like and would like to help them, but I don't really see an opportunity to work with them because I don't really see what makes them special. And sometimes I can get involved with the firms and help them identify what makes them special and offer some consulting time to kind of share what I know and be able to, you know, let them know what they don't know from what else is out there and help them better position themselves to figure out, okay, what is it that I do or could be doing that makes me special compared to my competitors and that would allow me to bring in more advisors and to what are some services that I can provide to the advisors to help them grow quicker or to add value to them. But if you're recruiting advisors or you're buying practices or you're merging with practices with the primary motivation of fattening your bottom line, I think that you're going to be swimming upstream as well just as much as the advisors are with their clients in the future because there are going to be other firms out there that are able to offer the exact same things that you are, but they are recruiting advisors so that they can improve the advisors' practices. They are buying practices so that they can help those practices thrive and flourish and be more successful for the advisors within the practice and for the clients within the practice. And they are merging with other firms because they see synergies and 2+2=5 situations that could take place there where they could bring a large benefit to these practices that they're merging with and see teamwork kind of adding to efficiencies and making more productive end outcomes. And most of the firms that are doing it that way tend to be very adaptable and very open-minded to negotiations and discussions. And I think that's a great key attribute that some of the successful M&A and some of the fastest growing firms have is they're very flexible in the way they approach these conversations with advisors. And if you are strictly trying to fatten your bottom line, then you've usually got a process and a metric and a payout and a multiple that you're willing to pay and nothing more. And you're very rigid to that. And you'll get your opportunities and you'll win a few of them, but I think you're going to win fewer and fewer every year. So I hope that this is thought-provoking. I hope it's insightful. I don't know if I gave you any answers whatsoever. Probably not. But I hope this was something that at least gives you some, you know, philosophical food for thought and some things to ponder in your practice. And hey, if I did raise any questions for yourself that you struggle to answer, then that's one of the things I've kind of learned is a great way to do business for me. I ask questions I don't have the answers to right now, and then you can reach out to me and we can talk, and then maybe after a few conversations, I may be able to help you find those answers for yourself. Would love to do that. You can reach out to me a variety of ways. I always put my number in the description, 919-561-2436. You can send me an email to garrett@theadvisoradvocates.com. Or go to theadvisoradvocates.com, and I believe it's the Connect tab, so theadvisoradvocates.com/connect takes you to my calendar link, and you can schedule a phone call or a Zoom call at your convenience. We can have a 30-minute, 45-minute chat, get to know each other a little bit, and if I can help, would love to do that. And if you're an advisor who is weighing your options, looking at different firms, thinking about selling, I always take the blank canvas approach with each conversation. I want to get to know everyone, let you kind of tell me your story and where you want to go, and then dig into the details a little bit and figure out how to get you there. But I am far, far, far more on the consulting side than I am the sales side, so I'm not here to push anybody any direction or another. I would just love to hear where you're looking to go, and if I am able to help give you some information to help you get there, that would be great. So I appreciate your time. Thank you for listening. Thank you for watching if you're on YouTube. Hope to talk to you soon. Have a great day.